You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
Well, I didn't see that coming. Which is more than Jeffrey Toobin's former colleagues at The New Yorker can say. Toobin is the author and reporter who lost his job after 27 years as a staff writer at The New Yorker and was suspended from his side hustle as a talking head on CNN after he pulled out his dick during a Zoom meeting with his colleagues from The New Yorker shortly before the 2020 election and had a wank. What I didn't see coming was Toobin's return last week to CNN. In the most supremely awkward 9 minutes of television since Donald Trump had to make his way down that ramp Antifa and Black Lives Matter smeared with grease on George Soros' orders, Allison Camerota spent 9 minutes, going over what Toobin did, the decisions he made that day, and basically allowed Toobin to plead inanity. Toobin made an inane argument. I'm not going to play the nearly nine-minute clip. It's not hard to find if you want to go watch. Toobin says he wasn't thinking. He didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know the camera was on. But what he does know and what he does think is that he shouldn't have been fired for what he didn't know he was doing. And he went and worked in a food bank over the last 7 months, and he got a new book coming out. You know, as problematic and unsettling as Toobin's return to CNN was, I believe him. I don't think it was intentional. I mean, the wank was, of course it was. Your dick doesn't accidentally fall into your hands during a work meeting. But exposing himself to his colleagues like that, I don't think he intended to do that. But intent is hard to discern, and we don't want to live in a world. We certainly don't want to attend Zoom meetings in a world where guys can get away with jacking off in front of their coworkers so long as they create a little plausible deniability for themselves or reasonable doubt about their intent. Just saying, I didn't know the camera was on, can't be a get-out-of-jail-free card or an escape consequences for your actions free card. But Toobin didn't escape consequences. Toobin lost his job, and he will forever have to live with the infamy, which is to say I'm in partial agreement with former New Yorker editor Tina Brown. She didn't think The New Yorker should have fired Toobin. He embarrassed the magazine, Brown said, but mostly embarrassed himself. I think that's true. He did mostly embarrass himself. But he should have been fired for what essentially boiled down to sexually harassing his colleagues. And he was fired. That said, I don't think he has to go away forever. Some folks are saying Toobin is only getting a second chance because he's white, male, straight, and cisgender. Just as I don't want to live in a world where men, male, straight, white, cisgender, or otherwise can get away with jacking off in front of their coworkers, I don't want to live in a world where people don't get second chances. So maybe instead of arguing that Toobin shouldn't get a second chance because others, non-straight, non-white, non-cisgender, didn't get theirs or wouldn't get theirs, maybe we should insist that everyone get a second chance, like Toobin, and hold Toobin up as proof that everyone should get a second chance. He got his. Everyone deserves theirs. All right, coming up on the micro, tons of your Q's, lots of my A's, and the Magnum Savage Lovecast, Dr. Evan Goldstein from Bespoke Surgical joins us to talk buttholes, butt sex best practices, butt surgery. Subscribe to the Magnum at www.savagelovecast.com for my interview with Dr. Goldstein and more Savage Lovecast, twice as much show, more guests, more questions, and no ads if you subscribe to the Magnum at savagelovecast.com. All right, let's get on to it. Here's today's show. This episode is brought to you by Allform, premium customizable sofas and chairs shipped right to your door. For 20% off your perfect sofa, go to allform.com/savage.
This episode of the Lovecast is brought to you by the good folks at Squarespace. They make it easy to build a beautiful website, blog, or online store. head on over to squarespace.com/savage for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SAVAGE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by HelloFresh. Fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Go to HelloFresh.com/Savage12 and use the code SAVAGE12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping.
Hey, Dan. I have a sex success story for you. This is actually the woman who called several months ago with one-year-old twins who was wondering when her libido was ever going to come back. And your advice made me feel so validated, heard, and hopeful for the future. And I wanted to call back and let you know that last weekend, the kids were really tired. We put them to bed early and, you know, started fooling around. And I wasn't that into it, but I was like, okay, this will be good. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it just like, bam, came rushing back, and it was everything we hadn't done in, what, 18 months, 2 years of pregnancy, breastfeeding, newborn stage, just came back on the table. We pulled out the harnesses, the restraints, we did anal, we dirty talk, like just the kitchen sink was all over the bed, all over the bedroom, and it was amazing, and it took everything in my power not to yell, "Thank you, Dan," as I was coming so hard. So thank you, Dan, for your advice, your support, your good thoughts. And to any other postpartum mamas out there, it does come back and it feels so good once it's back.
Aw, that may be the best kind of success story. Very satisfying sex for you. And for me, the satisfaction of getting to say, "I told you so." Also the satisfaction of hearing you were right. Doesn't get any better than that when you host an advice podcast. Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing. And congrats. Congrats on getting your groove back. If you have a sexual success story you'd like to share with us, give us a call. Share it. We might open next week's Lovecast with your success story.
Hi, Dan and Tech Savvy At-Risk Youth. I am a cis male living in the Midwest, and my wife and I are in a monogamish relationship. And I have a question for you about coming out. I've heard a lot of talk on your podcasts about how it's important to own your sexuality. But my question becomes, when one person in the relationship is polyamorous and the other one is not, is it okay for one member of that relationship to say, "No, I don't want this to be out"? Because we're in a situation where my wife is seeking extramarital activities, and I'm totally fine with that, but I don't want our friend group, and it's a group of mutual friends that were very close, I don't want that friend group knowing that about me. And it's not exactly about me, it's our relationship, but my wife is the one who's polyamorous, and if she comes out, that's effectively like outing me as well as being in a polyamorous relationship. And I don't really want to deal with that. Now, am I just being a selfish ass, or is the person who's being pulled out of the closet into being in polyamorous relationships, do they have any say in this matter?
It doesn't sound like you're in a polyamorous relationship. It sounds like you're in an open relationship, a one-sided open relationship. Your wife is free to seek extramarital activities outside the relationship, and you're not interested or not allowed, depending on how kinky you are, you're not interested or not allowed to seek extramarital contact yourself. It's interesting you use the phrase and telling, and I think revealing, extramarital activities as opposed to other partners. Polyamory is concurrent, committed, romantic, sexual relationships. If your wife had a boyfriend or other boyfriends, that would be polyamory. If all your wife is doing is seeking out sex with other men occasionally, and maybe she might have some FWBs, some regulars, but they aren't committed, concurrent, romantic, and sexual relationships, well, then this isn't polyamory. This is openness. And if your wife was poly and she had another boyfriend, it would be a big ask for her boyfriend to join you and your wife in the socially monogamous closet. There's a lot of people out there who aren't sexually monogamous, but they're socially monogamous. A lot of people in open relationships don't want other people to know that they sometimes have three ways or that they have an open relationship, and they allow people to assume that they're monogamous, which is sort of the default setting. It's not always an unreasonable assumption, particularly for straight people. And there's a lot of couples out there in open relationships who fly under the radar, who allow people to make that assumption about them because they're more comfortable being perceived as monogamous. So they function as socially monogamous. Pretty easy, if all this is extramarital activities, for your wife to be discreet and allow you the comfort of still being perceived to be monogamous if that's important to you. A much bigger ask if she has another boyfriend or she has another girlfriend, and that person can never be publicly acknowledged, and your wife wants to form a partnership with that person, and that person wants to be your wife's partner as well, while recognizing and honoring perhaps your primacy as her, you know, nesting partner. It's a big ask for that person to never be publicly acknowledged as a partner, to never be able to go on a date, to never be able to be seen in public holding hands or in a romantic restaurant and having to police themselves constantly. But if that's not the sorts of relationships your wife is having with other men, it's not that big an ask for you to say, I value this perception. I value the perception that we are monogamous. I don't want to deal with the stigma or shame yet or right now. Of course, you're negotiating the terms of your relationship right now. You can continue to discuss and renegotiate the terms of your relationship going forward. And what you're comfortable with right now is not being out about being in an open relationship or a one-sided open relationship. Your wife can want it to be open. She could make that a condition of staying in this relationship with you at all. If she values that openness and freedom more than she values her relationship with you, she could choose it. One of you has to pay the price of admission here. You either have to pay the price of admission about being out if it's a deal breaker for your wife, or she has to pay the price of admission on being closeted about this if it's a deal breaker for you. So obviously you need to have a conversation with your wife, and it is fine for her to want this kind of openness, want to be out about it, and not get it right now. You may be more comfortable being out about being open in time, but you're not comfortable about being open right now. This is something that you either have to come to consensus about or you have to break up over. And I hope you're not going to break up over what would be for your wife at the moment, because this isn't a polyamorous relationship, merely open. What would be for your wife at the moment, a very small sacrifice. You've heard me sing the praises of our Helix mattress, a mattress that me and my husband adore. Mattresses that are built not just for excellent sleeping, but for excellent everything elsing that we do on our mattresses. Now I am excited to tell you that Helix has left the bedroom and started making sofas. They launched a new company called Allform, and they're already making the very best sofas you can get your butt on. With Allform, you can customize a sofa using premium materials and at a fraction of the cost of traditional stores. You pick your fabric, and it's a spill, stain, and scratch-resistant fabric. The sofa color, the color of the legs, sofa size, and shape to make sure it's perfect for you and perfect for your home. They have armchairs and love seats all the way up to an 8-seat sectional for everyone in your polycule, so there's something for literally everyone. And you can always start small and buy more seats later on if you want your Allform sofa to grow and change with you as you grow and change and move. Allform sofas are also delivered directly to your home with fast, free shipping. Allform takes just 3 to 7 days to arrive in the mail, and you can assemble it yourself in a few minutes. No tools needed. Or have Nancy do it, which is what I did. She said assembling our Allform love seat in our Savage Lovecast Studios waiting room was super easy. And I know it was super fast because it didn't take her long to do it. We love our Allform love seat. It's a cool retro teal color and it fits perfectly in our studio. It looks great. And my butt says it feels great. And if getting a sofa without trying it in the store sounds a little risky, you don't need to worry. You get 100 days to decide if you want to keep it. That's more than 3 months. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up for free and give you a full refund. They even offer a forever warranty, a literally forever warranty. To find your perfect sofa, check out allform.com/savage. And Allform is right now offering 20% off all orders for my listeners at allform.com. allform.com/savage. Let them know the Lovecast sent you at allform.com/savage for 20% off.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 30-year-old calling about an ugly situation my friend has found herself in. We started as coworkers at the same restaurant and have remained friends for years as I chose another career path and she stayed on to become the GM. During that period, she and the owner developed a romantic connection that became a full-on affair. He's currently married with kids, she's single, and he ended the affair recently, though he keeps her in the loop about his marriage and other things while they interact at work. As she tells it, he has on multiple occasions over the years expressed his desire to be with her exclusively and has given her real-time updates each time he and his wife have agreed to a divorce, then patch things up later. Needless to say, this roller coaster has caused my friend a terrible amount of emotional distress. Recently, the owner said that he was getting divorced again. My friend tried to keep her hopes from getting up, but 2 weeks later, when he announced to her that he's going to try and keep the marriage together once more, she crashed into the deepest depression I've seen from her yet. Obviously, this is a toxic situation, and my friend acknowledges that she needs to get a new job, but she's trepidatious because she loves her current job. Personally, I'm not sure even she knows how much of this love is or isn't tied to the emotional volatility associated with her boss. I recently offered to help her find a new job. She accepted, and within 12 hours through a mutual friend, she was recommended to interview at a place that pays better and is very similar to where she works now, provided she sent in her resume. I helped her update her resume, and a week later, she still hasn't sent it in. So my question comes in two parts. First, I'm concerned that my friend is stuck in such a toxic, manipulative cycle with her boss, someone who I personally know to be toxic and manipulative, that she can't see the way out even when the door is open for her. What's the best way to support someone in this situation without being pushy or overstepping boundaries? Second, while I'm happy to be a supportive confidant, this cycle has existed for almost 4 years, and it's becoming harder for me to engage with her emotional lows while she continually hesitates to take action. I'm angry for her, and it's painful to watch her go through this. How can I express this to her in a productive way?
It's really one question. The best way to help her, and how do you express to her in a productive way that this is emotionally exhausting for you? The best way to do both is to tell her you're done. You're not going to talk with her about this anymore. That this is a toxic, shitty relationship. That what this guy is doing, her boss is doing, is transparent. He's never going to leave his wife. He's never going to break up his family. He's never going to be with her exclusively or marry her. But he's going to toss that prospect out whenever he needs to keep stringing her along. And it's destroying her. And she is turning to you and perhaps some other friends to do all the emotional labor of putting her back together again and setting her on her feet again when the predictable happens. It's as if she keeps shooting herself in the foot with the exact same fucking gun, and you're expected to drop everything each time she does that and rush in and stop the bleeding. And what you need to tell her is that you are done. You are exhausted, that you can no longer provide her with the crutch, the emotional support that you've been providing her. At a certain point, when someone is stuck in kind of a loop like this in a toxic relationship, our emotional support becomes enabling. It's almost as if that person, your friend in this case, can tell herself that you believe in the relationship too. Perhaps subconsciously tell herself that, maybe consciously tell herself that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be making the emotional investment in the relationship, you know, a bank shot emotional investment, but still an emotional investment that you are making by being there for her each and every time the inevitable happens, each and every time she shoots herself in the same fucking foot with the same fucking gun, and it hurts and bleeds in the same predictable fucking way. Drop off a box of bandages. That's what you're going to do. You're going to drop off a box of bandages. You're going to go to her and have one last conversation. Here are all the bandages I can possibly provide you. Get the fuck out of this relationship. I lined up an interview for you for a much better job in a different place to get you away from your fucking boss with higher pay, and you didn't take it. Which either means, and this is you are saying this to your friend, either this means you can't be helped and therefore I am wasting my time, or you don't want to be helped and therefore I am wasting my time. So here, one last time, I'm offering you the box of bandages. I'm offering you the help that I can give you, which is this kind of blunt, straight talk, and also the logistical help of lining up a new job, getting your resume together, helping you get that interview so you can get the fuck out of this place and away from this guy. Last chance. And if she doesn't take it, let her call someone else. When he says he's about to leave his wife again and she picks up the gun again and shoots herself in the same fucking foot with the same fucking bullet, tell her she has to call someone else. You are not going to rush in then with the bandages because you dropped them all off at her place the last time you talked to her about it. The Savage Lovecast is sponsored by HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy and fun. HelloFresh cuts out stressful meal planning and grocery store trips, so you can enjoy getting dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes. HelloFresh offers more than 27 recipes to choose from each week, from vegetarian meals and calorie-smart choices to Kraft burgers and extra special gourmet options. There's something for everyone to enjoy with all recipes designed and tested by professional chefs and nutritional experts to ensure deliciousness and simplicity. I'm not the cook in the family. Terry's the cook in the family. I do the dishes, but I love how HelloFresh gives Terry new ideas on what to cook. This week, we're looking forward to making balsamic fig chicken with roasted potatoes and mixed greens. Last week, we loved the spinach ricotta stuffed ravioli. We also love how they offer so many vegetarian options. We take advantage of those a lot, and it's helped us reduce meat from our diet, which is better for us and better for the planet. Go to HelloFresh.com/Savage12 and use the code Savage12 for, I hope you're sitting down, 12 free meals, including shipping. HelloFresh.com/Savage12. Use the code Savage12. Let them know the Savage Lovecast sent you, and you will get 12 free meals, again, including free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit.
Hey, Dan. You said that furries were like leather fetishists, but I thought all furries didn't have sex in the furry suit. But don't all leather fetishists, they all have sex in varying degrees of, well, what do they do? I don't know, Dan. Can you say more?
Sure, I can say more. You can also get on the internet and do a little surfing around yourself and find plenty of examples of people who are furries, people who are into fursuits, who have fursonas, having sex. There's a lot of furry porn out there. There's a lot of really great furry animation and furry comics and cartoons that are sexually explicit, but there's also a lot of people in full-on fursuits having sex. Matt Baum was on the show a couple of weeks ago. He's done a deep dive into furrydom and the furry scene. There are people in furrydom, furverts, they don't like to be called, or some of them actually do embrace that term in the same way that some of us gay men embrace the term fag. There are people out there into this who are honest about the fact that it is a sexual thing for them and there's a sexual and erotic component. But there are lots of people involved in furrydom where it's not about sex. It's about escaping into these personas, into some other reality, and stepping outside yourself. That seems more prevalent in furrydom, that contingent. That seems larger in furrydom, the people for whom the fursuits and everything else isn't necessarily erotic than it is or would be in the leather scene. Most people who are into leather, most people who are leather fetishists enjoy wearing gear and wearing leather during sex. But in either case, it's not hard to find proof online at any number of different porn sites that there are people out there into leather who are wearing leather while they're having sex, and there are people who are furries who are into fursuits, who are wearing their fursuits while having sex. So dig around a little bit. You won't have to take my word for it. You can find the proof for yourself.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. They make it easy to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store without being some kind of fancy web developer or coding genius. They have everything you need: domains, marketing tools, analytics, e-commerce. Squarespace empowers millions of creative types and entrepreneurs by providing them with the tools they need to bring their creative ideas to life. Squarespace can really help you with your creative project or business venture. For instance, you can present your work using Squarespace's professional portfolio designs, display projects in one of their customizable galleries, and add password-protected pages to share private work with clients. And everything you make with Squarespace translates perfectly to mobile. And if you ever need help, they have 24/7 support. Head on over to squarespace.com/savage for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SAVAGE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/savage and use the offer code SAVAGE.
Hi, Dan, 30-something-year-old woman calling from the West Coast with the question in the aftermath of a very serious fight I just had with one of my oldest friends, unhelpfully right after their wedding, therefore ruining the end of our trip, which is something I'm feeling really terrible about, but also not asking you to weigh in on whether or not I was the asshole here because everyone agrees that I was. But just curious what your thoughts are on the conversation that we were having generally and how to have it in the future. Because basically what I was saying was that there we were talking about fetishes and then we're talking about pedophilia. And I was saying that there are people for whom pedophilia is a sexual orientation and it doesn't have anything to do with them molesting children necessarily if they don't act on it, and that they are pretty tortured by this and they can't change their desires. They can change obviously whether or not they act on their desires, but that those people need to be treated with some love and kindness because they have this thing about them that everybody deems them a monster for and they can't do anything about it. And so I said to my friend who is trans, I would think that you would potentially be able to understand that because there's, you know, a lot of people that would hate and vilify trans people and you guys can't do anything about that either. And he took that as me comparing him to a pedophile, which it was not at all what I was saying. So everyone agrees I should never have said that. I can completely take responsibility for the fact that that was very, very poorly chosen wording or and just topic and so forth. But I'm just curious, I guess, A, how do you try to present this information to people? And then also, is there ever a way to have a conversation about this with somebody who is gay or trans in a way that they might hear it? I don't know if it even matters. Like, it's not a hill I'm worth, I feel like dying on, but I just feel frustrated that it was so unable to be heard as far as the point that I was trying to make because it was triggering for the other person. So I guess I'm just asking like how you might have handled that had you been having that conversation. And then also, I don't really know exactly how the best way for me to apologize to my friend is because he said he never wants to be friends with me again because of this. And I hope that's not the case because we've been friends for over 20 years. So I just feel like anything that I say will be kind of twisted and turned around. And I'm curious how you might go about giving a sincere apology for something like this.
Well, if you want to patch things up with your friend, and I assume that you want to, it sounds like you want to, just go and make an abject shit-eating apology. That's the only way out. Apologize profusely and without a but. Apologize without then wanting to re-argue or relitigate the point you were trying to make. Just fucking drop it. That said, the point you were trying to make is kind of legit. The apt comparison, though, isn't to gender identity, pedophilia and gender identity. The closer comparison is pedophilia and sexual orientation. James Cantor is a sex researcher in Canada. He's been doing really the only large-scale studies in the world of people who are pedophiles. And we shouldn't confuse people who are pedophiles with people who are child molesters. Not all pedophiles offend. That is, not all pedophiles molest children, and not all people who've sexually abused or molested children are pedophiles. What Cantor studies are pedophiles, people who are attracted to minors. And he's done large-scale studies, brain scans of pedophiles, and put together an enormous body of evidence really kind of definitively proving that pedophilia is, quote, biologically predetermined. It is not a choice. It is a sexual orientation. And a curse, because it's a sexual orientation that a person who is a pedophile, through no fault or choice of their own, can never act on. There is no way for a pedophile to express who they are sexually without, well, express who they are sexually with a minor, with their preferred objects of desire, without raping a child, without doing harm. And we need to help people who are cursed with this sexual orientation with support. We need to help them with therapy and with counseling, if only to protect children that they might otherwise sexually abuse. If what we want is to live in a world where children are not sexually abused, making sure that people who have, through no fault or choice of their own, pedophilia as their sexual orientation aren't acting on those desires means providing those people with some support so that they won't act on those desires. So I say all these things as a gay man, as a person with a minority sexual orientation. And as a gay man, as someone with a minority sexual orientation that was deeply stigmatized and is in many parts of the world still deeply stigmatized, I empathize with pedophiles around that experience of having a deeply stigmatized sexual orientation. At the same time, as a moral actor, I'm able to recognize that that stigma around acting on pedophilic desires needs to be cemented in place, needs to be upheld to protect children. I can act on my used to be universally deeply stigmatized, now regionally deeply stigmatized sexual orientation with other consenting adults and do no harm. A pedophile can't act on their universally deeply stigmatized sexual orientation without doing harm. And we need to provide pedophiles with resources, counseling, therapy, and I think some degree of empathy for their plight in order to help them not offend. So I'm with you. Again, I think the more apt comparison is pedophilia and heterosexuality, pedophilia and homosexuality, bisexuality. It is a sexual orientation. It is that deep. It is at that level. Not, I think, exactly parallel to gender identity. And I think your friend overreacted just because you were saying that perhaps they should be able to empathize with pedophiles as a trans person. I think anyone of any sexual orientation or gender identity should be able to empathize with someone who hasn't offended, who's never molested a child, and struggles with this cursed sexual orientation every day of their lives. So while I'm with you, and I get the point you were trying to make, that's not going to help with this particular friend and the whole extended friend group that are pissed at you for blowing up the wedding on the last day, blowing up the trip. So don't get into an argument. Don't Google James Cantor and The Walrus. There's a terrific piece about James Cantor and his research into pedophilia at The Walrus that you might want to read. Don't Google that. Don't send the link to your friend. Just call your friend and make an abject, shit-eating apology. Take it back and apologize. Apologize, apologize, apologize for blowing up the wedding, which you do feel bad about, and you can offer a sincere apology about. You can hear the dot, 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 but in your head, but don't say it out loud.
Hey, Dan, Nancy, and the tech-savvy at-risk youth. Quick question about requesting masturbation videos or just seeing if an ex has an OnlyFans. I was with somebody about 8 years ago, and he is just stuck with me. And I regularly masturbate to men jerking off, and I always pick men that look like him. So it's probably not a good idea to reach out to him, but I don't know what's the harm.
If your ex has an OnlyFans, you don't have to reach out to him. You can just subscribe to his OnlyFans and enjoy his videos. If your ex doesn't have an OnlyFans and you would like some video of him to fuel your masturbatory fantasies and your obsession with your ex, which I'm not necessarily endorsing, that is a strategy to get over and get past your ex, maybe find somebody else who turns you on as much or more than your ex did and does. It depends on who your ex is, whether you should reach out to him. If your ex is a kind of sex-positive person, if you think, knowing what you know of your ex, that he would get off on knowing you're out there masturbating about him and still sexually obsessed with him, if you have a friendly rapport, and sometimes maybe you recount your war stories with each other and update your body counts, if you have that kind of relationship with your ex, asking that kind of ex that you have that kind of relationship with for some FAP material or WAP material, wet ass pussy material, to enjoy and get off on despite no longer being in a relationship, yeah, that could be appropriate. That could be welcome. If you don't have that kind of relationship with your ex, and this would just be a bolt from the blue, what's the harm? Well, you could offend your ex. If you have, you know, a mildly friendly relationship with your ex, if you're in touch a little bit about non-sexual shit, you're risking that. You're risking the relationship you do have with your ex. Only you know if risking that, if losing the contact that you do have with them would be worth it, worth the possibility of getting your hands on that kind of FAP video, or sorry, WAP video for yourself. And if the answer is yes, well, okay, well, there's the potential harm. I doubt your ex will be traumatized by the request. I don't think he'll be curled up in the fetal position on the floor of his therapist's office after getting that email. It'll give him a story to tell his friends, maybe. You might get gossiped about a little bit, but even if the answer is no, I don't think you're going to do harm here. And again, if you have that kind of friendly sexual swapping war stories and body counts relationship with your ex, some people have those kinds of relationships with your ex, he might enjoy making and sending that video to you. So what kind of relationship do you have with your ex? Answer that question and then decide what you're willing to risk, and then you'll know what you need to do. And if he's really that hot and you get your hands on that video and it's okay with him for you to share it with me, go ahead and email it in.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 24-year-old gay male, and I have a question about Grindr etiquette. Specifically, is it inappropriate to block somebody after they send you a photo of themselves? My friend and I have been discussing this, and she says that it is totally inappropriate, and she would just continue on with the conversation and then slowly ghost the person. Whereas my outlook on it was, I just find that to be a waste of time. And I think there's probably a better way of expressing your sort of disinterest in somebody's looks without blocking them right away. Maybe just with a simple line or two. Do you have any input or advice here?
Grindr is a cold, brusque place. And everybody who gets on Grindr knows that, should know it, quickly discovers it. That said, I think what you do here depends on the golden rule. What you would like done to yourself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Golden rule applies even on Grindr. So if you sent your photo to someone, caller, and they weren't interested after seeing your photos, what would you like them to do? Would you like them to politely say, hey, thanks, I don't think we're a match, and then block you? Okay, then you should say that to people who send you their photos and you're not interested. Hey, I don't think we're a match. You might want to block them quickly so you don't have to get into an argument. If they have a really negative, argumentative reaction to you trying to be as polite as possible as you shut it down because you're not interested. Or would you rather them just block you and not draw it out? Some people would rather not have their time wasted. Some people would tell you that they don't want to, you know, someone to make them think they're still in contention when they're not in contention. And you shouldn't assume, it's a little self-centered to assume that you're the only person that someone who's on Grindr blasting out photos is talking to. They might not even notice that you blocked them and disappeared on them if they were fielding queries and photographs from six or seven other potential gentlemen callers. So I think the thing to do here is the thing you would like done. If you are on the receiving end, maybe that's a bad choice of words. If you were the person who sent out the photo who is going to get rejected, would you rather a polite thanks, but no thanks? Or would you rather just the person ghost you? Since there's no hard and fast rule here and people, Grindr users, really do come down on both sides, let me down easy or just disappear, I think you can make a choice here informed by what you would like done unto you.
Hi, Dan. I am the cis hetero father of two boys, 6 and 12. Their mother and I have always prioritized open and age-appropriate communication about any and all difficult and complicated topics, including sex and gender identity, body image, consent, etc. With my older son rapidly approaching puberty and all the tumultuous changes that go along with it, we've been talking more about his thoughts and feelings about an understanding of sexuality and relationships, and especially what his friends are doing, talking about, and exposing him to. I recently purchased a copy of Let's Talk About It, The Teen's Guide to Sex, Relationships, and Being a Human by Eric Moen and Matthew Nolan. I'm feeling very comfortable approaching just about all the topics in the book, including anatomy, masturbation, communication, different types of relationships, gender identity, sexual identity, and even trauma and abuse. There's just one thing I can't wrap my head around: how to approach porn. I'm 37, and when I was my son's age, the internet was just becoming a thing. We actually had a physical paper book, like the phone book, that listed websites, including a few adult sites where I first got exposed to some admittedly pretty vanilla pictures of naked people and sex. These days, though, it's just fucking madness. I am as open as the next person to the world of sexual expression, but there's some shit, like a lot of shit, on the internet that no one should be exposed to or involved in, especially a young person who's just forming their understanding of sex and intimacy. I guess I feel okay about talking to my son about this and being really frank about my feelings about what's definitely okay porn, like verifiably consensual, respectfully made porn, and kind of questionable porn, which honestly to me I think is most of the porn on the internet, and outright immoral and illegal acts being depicted that would horrify most people. So we can talk about it, even though it's really, really tricky, but what do I do when he actually wants to start to explore what's out there? How does a responsible sex and body positive parent participate in allowing their kids to dive into this insane world of pornography? Because it's definitely going to happen, whether I like it or not.
It's going to happen. Your son's going to get online and he's going to look at pornography, and it's going to happen, like you say, whether you like it or not. And your sons are going to spelunk into the stuff that interests them, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's well-produced, respectfully produced, ethically produced, whether it's a good representation of human intimacy or not. So you just have to recognize and accept that you aren't in control of this. And instead of trying to regulate what your son looks at, you really need to make sure that when your son starts looking, he's looking with a critical eye. You need to tell him that porn represents a kind of kabuki sex, as I like to call it. It's heightened, it's fictionalized, it's exaggerated, and the things people do in porn aren't necessarily the things people do in real life. And porn can distort what intimacy in a relationship and actual real sex in a relationship is like. And it's not that hard to get that across to a kid. All you have to say is, you know how Disney movies aren't real life? You know how action movies, thrillers, different kinds of TV shows that we have watched and enjoyed together, and we're not going to be watching and enjoying porn together, but those different kinds of TV shows don't really bear a resemblance to real life. Real life isn't like an action movie. Well, porn isn't like real life sex. It's a simulation. It's an exaggeration. And porn isn't, in the same way, like real life sex. Your sons are going to be exposed to a lot of things. Some of those things are going to click for them. You know, a lot of the stuff that's online, a lot of the porn that's online, we wring our hands about it shaping people's tastes, but a lot of people go looking for the porn that is to their tastes. I think where porn has a distorting effect is shaping people's expectations, and not just for boys, what they can expect from their sex partners, but what might be expected from them by their sex partners. And I think that's a place where you as a parent get in. You talk about expectations. You talk about reasonable expectations. You talk about how literally the people you're watching in porn are like the people you're watching at the circus. They're professionals. You don't see your dad and mom getting up there on the trapeze in the same way. Some of the stuff, the very athletic, crazy off-the-wall stuff you see in porn, they're basically the contortionists and aerialists of the sex world. They're circus performers, but for sex. You need to really build those sorts of filters into your son's brain so that when he is taking in porn, he is viewing it critically and he's viewing it with this understanding that it shouldn't shape his expectations, that sex is about pleasure. It's great that you got him Erica Moen and Matthew Nolan's book, that sex is about pleasure. It's about consent. It's about mutual pleasure. And sex and intimacy and pleasure can be low key. It doesn't have to be the circus. It can be the circus if he wants to run away and join the sex circus one day, not as a porn performer, but perhaps, have crazy athletic off-the-wall sex with a consenting partner who enjoys him, who wants the same things that he does if he wants those things. But he doesn't have to want those things, the crazy things he might see in porn, and he definitely shouldn't go into his first relationships expecting those things. That's what you can do as a parent. You can make your kid a critical viewer of porn. You're not going to be able to control what porn or what kind of porn your kid ultimately chooses to view. All right, before we get to your response, calls, listener feedback, let's read some listener tweets. Thomas Carver tweets, so at Fake Dan Savage just dropped some wisdom on today's Savage Lovecast. One sure sign of a sketchy top at a BDSM event is if he starts a sentence with, a real bottom wouldn't, ... Same goes the other way too, of course, a real top wouldn't, ... Also gross as hell. Thank you, Thomas. Not just at BDSM events, though, as I'm sure you'd agree, the place people are likeliest to encounter this a real bottom wouldn't bullshit is online. And without being able to see everyone else at the munch roll their eyes, or even better, loudly object to that bullshit, a kinky person, a shy sub, in search of their first experience with a dom, is a lot more vulnerable to that kind of bullshit on a dating app or on FetLife than a person is at a BDSM event. Lisa Brody tweets, the Savage Lovecast is always educational, but learning the German word for birth control pills is anti-baby pillen for real is worth the fee for my Magnum subscription. Thank you, Dan Savage. Well, thank you, Lisa Brody. I heard from some other listeners that my German pronunciation could use a little work. I clearly need to spend more time with people who speak that language. I am Y Voss tweets, I'm 35 and just came out as bi to my parents today. Of all the reactions I expected from my father, saying, I get why you like women, I like women too, was not one of them. Thanks, Dan, for the encouragement to come out via years of listening. Hashtag bi visibility, hashtag happy pride. Welcome out, I am Y Voss, and happy pride to you. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing your handle, so forgive me for that. But thank you for doing your part by coming out to your family. Coming out to our families, taking that risk is why we've come as far as we have. And as I like to say, coming out is scary, but sometimes our families surprise us like I Am Y Voss's family surprised her. All right. Thank you for your tweets. Thanks to everyone who posted to your social media about the Savage Lovecast this week. We appreciate it. And now, listener response calls.
Hey Dan, I'm calling in response to the woman from last episode who found the image her husband had made of her sister on her husband's laptop. She mentioned not being able to go to therapy until the fall. If this was a blocked artery or something serious like that, she wouldn't wait that long to get it fixed, and mental health needs to be as important as physical health. She needs to call a friend, get a family member, probably not her sister, of course, but do whatever it takes to carve out that time to get the help she needs, and it's important, and she deserves it.
Hey, Dan, this is a comment for the person that called in who's finally in a healthy relationship after sustained abuse and is checking out during sex. I have had a very, very similar history and experienced that similarly in my current awesome relationship. And I just want to say that when you're already disassociating, sometimes fighting to be like, oh, let's talk dirty to get present is moving against stream. And I've found real success for myself when I just let myself disassociate even further and go into what my like masturbation fantasies are and my deep fantasies. And then once I'm in them and I'm feeling good again, I can sort of bring my lover into them. Like I experience them coming into them with me. So sometimes it's easier not to fight against it, but to just go with what your body and your erotic mind is asking you to do in order to enjoy the moment.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to episode 763, the woman who is having trouble climaxing with her boyfriend after an abusive relationship. I'm just calling because I have the same exact experience. I'm a 30-year-old woman who is in an emotionally abusive relationship for 6 years, who has OCD, who has a lot of trouble climaxing with my amazing partner now. And I just wanted this caller to know that she's not alone. Dan's advice was excellent. I would also suggest communicating with your partner beforehand and, you know, helping yourself get off when you're able to. But yeah, I just wanted to say she's not alone. She's going to be okay.
And we're going to leave it there. Got a question for me or a comment about this week's show? There are two ways to get them to us. You can call the Savage Lovecast at 206-302-2064 and leave a message. Or you can use the voice memo app on your phone to record your question or your comment and email it to us at voicemail@savagelovecast.com. Join our Facebook group. The Savage Love Facebook group is weirdly just getting started. I've always been a late adopter of new technologies, but please join us. And if you know someone who's a fan of the show and that person has a birthday or wedding coming up, give them the gift of the Savage Lovecast Magnum by going to savagelovecast.com and clicking on Gift. More questions, more guests, access to the entire Savage Lovecast archive, special hangouts for Magnum subscribers, special interviews, and no ads at the Savage Lovecast Magnum version. You might want to give yourself the gift of the Magnum Lovecast 2 while you're at it. Follow me on Twitter at @FakeDanSavage. Follow Dr. Evan Goldstein at Bespoke Surgical on Twitter at Bespoke Surgical. You can also find Bespoke Surgical online at BespokeSurgical.com. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thank you for downloading.